The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Psalm 103, verses 19 through 22. Psalm 103, beginning at verse 19. The Lord has established his throne in the heavens, and his kingdom rules over all. Bless the Lord, O you his angels, you mighty ones who do his word, hearkening to the voice of his word. Bless the Lord, all his hosts, his ministers that do his will. Bless the Lord, all his works in all places of his dominion. Bless the Lord, O my soul. Let's bow together for prayer. Help us, our Father, in these moments together to understand the lordship of Christ and our role under his lordship. Help us to understand the institutions of his kingdom. For his kingdom indeed rules over all. Help us to understand, our Father, in new measure, the complexities and yet perhaps the simplicities of the interrelations between Christians and non-Christians and between different institutions of society. For these theoretical sounding issues are very critical in very practical ways among many of us today. Be in our midst, give us a good experience with each other, and encourage us, we pray in Jesus' name, amen. We're going to do a couple of things in here today, and then we may do some other things too that I don't have planned, things that you have planned. I'm going to talk for a little bit, not very long, probably 20 or 30 minutes, about some things, and then Alan Strange is here, who is the moderator of the Presbytery of New Jersey, of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, and it just so happens that he has with him a case study that rather conveniently fits into the materials that I'd like to suggest to you today, and we can then hear from him about his case study, which I think is tremendously significant. Maybe at this point in only a small way, but the ramifications of it are incredible. So he will present that case study for you, and then he would probably be grateful if you would tell him what the Lord's will is in that matter for the presbytery and for himself, so that he can tell the people that don't agree with him that he now knows what the Lord's will is in that case study. So I'd like to talk about the relationship between the church and the state just a little bit, and beginning in this kind of study had to do with studying the relationship between the church and business. There are many institutions of society, schools, business, church, government, all kinds of different institutions, hospitals. But one of the institutions of society is business. And the church, now in this, I'm going to have to define church almost every time I use it. The church, meaning by that the large mainline churches, those that are more identified with the National Council of Churches, has taken upon itself to criticize and attack business in a variety of ways. Largely through shareholder resolutions. And I don't know that you know anything about that business, but this is a book of church proxy resolutions of 3 or 4 years ago, nuclear power alternatives, nuclear power plant, resolution of the Philadelphia Electric Company, Carolina Power and Light Company, Union Electric, resolution with Texas Utilities. So all these resolutions have been presented to these companies at their annual meetings by the churches. specifically by the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility. And these resolutions in this particular book, in this particular year, largely concern corporate governance, which would have to do with minorities on the corporate board, energy and environment, equality, Latin America and the world debt crisis, Northern Ireland, South Africa, international marketing, and the military situation. And then there are dozens of resolutions that were presented to different companies in that particular year. Now, that kind of ministry has some advantages to it. One is it's pretty cheap. All you need is a few shares in a company, 100 shares, and you can present a shareholder resolution. So a denomination that holds 100 shares of General Electric Company can present a resolution to General Electric Company at the annual meeting. And they can pick it out front and get in the newspaper and get all kinds of publicity. And they only get 100 votes for their resolution, the 100 shares they own. But they get a lot of publicity. If they get 3% of the vote, then they can present it again the next year, at which time they have to get 6% of the vote. And they almost always lose by a large margin. But they do get a lot of publicity, and sometimes the causes that they represent seem to be ethical. That is, if a company is misusing Indonesian employees, perhaps the company ought to be made aware of that, and the owners of the company are responsible for that. And you say, you don't care about that sort of thing. But you own a share of stock or two, maybe. Or maybe if you don't, your pension plan does. And therefore, that makes you party to that company, I assume, that's misusing its employees in Indonesia. So that becomes a very big issue. And you have to ask yourself, what are you going to do? Stand up and fight, or write to the company, or sell your stock and be mad and go away? So that's a very complicated issue in our world today. Now, most conservatives would say the church shouldn't be in that business, and they're probably right. But then I got a letter from a conservative group that was trying to do the same thing for conservative causes, and I didn't bring the letter with me, but it is a quite easy thing to do. And I think one of the problems with it is it diverts energy from other things the church might do. And I'm not quite sure how the church determined God's will for South Africa anyway, because many of these resolutions urge American business to withdraw from South Africa. And frankly, I think that's wrong and bad for South Africa. At least that's what the black people in South Africa told me. But I don't know that their opinion counts. I know some black people in South Africa want business to withdraw, don't misunderstand me, but I don't know how the church determines God's will in all of these issues. I wrote 1 year to all of the secretaries of the corporations that received these, about 50, Secretary of General Electric, Secretary of ITT, Secretary of Polaroid, they were involved in this, and asked what effect these resolutions had on the companies. And almost unanimously, they said none at all. And they said they would have had more effect if they had come to us personally first and said, we have this concern, why don't you do something about it? But then, of course, they wouldn't have gotten the publicity from it. But you might at least be interested in that. And that's where my study began. But then it led to other things for other reasons, and particularly to studying the relationship between the church and the other institutions of society. Now, you have in your materials, you should have a thing with three boxes that looks sort of like this. If you turn to that, I will say a word or two about it. What I'm going to try to do in the next 15 minutes or so is summarize an 11-page talk and then an 18-page talk quickly. I realize that when you try to be simple, or graphic, or you know, try to perform in a way that people can visualize things, you run all kinds of errors of inconsistency and I mean all kinds of possibilities of inconsistency. So in this little thing that I'm presenting to you, there may be many inconsistencies. I know of some. I can point out some. But it's just an effort to see if we can't understand the relationship between the church and the state a little more clearly than we might otherwise understand it. So here's the little graph that's in front of you, and here it is up on the board. And up on the top is the Lordship of Christ. And you might notice that the way I drew it, there's no end on it. It's not a box. It's open-ended. So the Lordship of Christ just keeps on extending in both directions. That is, it goes way out here, and if you wanted to, you could draw another box out here and put family. And you could come out here and draw another box and put business, if you wanted to. So the Lordship of Christ extends infinitely in both directions. By the way, I heard, I think it was on the radio the other day, it was curious, that God has removed our sins from us as far as the east is from the west. I don't know why this came to mind, but it was interesting to me, and you may remember this if I say tell you, that how far is the east from the west? You know, and you just keep going around and around. You can go east forever, or you can go west forever, but you can't go north or south forever. And but you're all nodding, so you all heard that before. I mean, if you go north up to the North Pole, then you go south. And whereas east and west go around and around. I'm sure the author of the Bible didn't intend that, but it just struck me as interesting. At any rate, here are three institutions that I'm suggesting to you, all of which function under the Lordship of Christ, because everything functions under the Lordship of Christ. There is nothing in all of the universe, past, present, or future, that doesn't in some way relate to the Lordship of Christ and function under his Lordship. And the first thing we might look at is space science, for example, space science. And my suspicion is that most of us have really missed the fact that we live in a pretty dramatic era, the era of space science. This is the era in which man escaped from his environment. And my suspicion is that if the Lord doesn't come in the meantime, 20,000 years from now, that will look approximately like the discovery of the wheel. You know, when people look back and say, what were the great events of history? Well, there was the wheel and fire and man escaped from his environment. And you know, we just sort of take it for granted, spaceships running around, one came back. But anyway, space science, or science in general, or chemical science, whatever you want, even medical science, is an institution. In a sense, part of our society. Now, where does space science get its authority? Well, my answer would be from God. Well, where would I find that? Well, I would probably find that in Genesis, and you might not agree with this, but if not, we'll change it just a little bit, where God tells man to subdue the earth. Now, you might say, yeah, that's earth, but not space. But I would see it as an extension of that command to subdue the earth, to go up and examine the moon when you get a chance. You know, go on out into space further if you can, that man is to subdue the universe. Now, if you don't like that, then you can change this one to chemical science, if that'll suit you better. So, Jesus Christ, or God, gives authority to space science, and the origin of that is man's high calling in the universe, and the mandate of space science, or of all science, is to subdue the earth. Now, that is a mandate that I assume Adam had before the fall, but it's not changed after the fall. It's just going to be tougher. It'd been a lot easier if Adam hadn't sinned. I think he'd made progress more easily. But it's still what he's supposed to do, subdue the earth. And who are the subjects? Who are the people who work in this box? Scientists. Some of them are Christians, some of them are not. Who knows what the percentage is, and doesn't make any difference. Some of the ones that aren't Christians might be better scientists than the ones that are. Would you prefer to be operated on by a Christian neurosurgeon who had never had a successful case, or a non-Christian neurosurgeon who was world-renowned for never having failed? I'd probably go with the latter one. I'd be glad to go to church with the former one, but I'd go with the latter one. So the fact that you're a Christian, if you'll pardon the expression, Christian scientist, the fact that you're a Christian scientist doesn't give you any special advantages, except that you're a Christian. I mean, that doesn't give you any scientific advantages. The only reason science can exist is because of Jesus Christ. He's the creator of the universe. He's also the sustainer of the universe. You have to remember that. If Jesus Christ were not the sustainer of the universe, if it all didn't hold together in him, space travel would be absolutely ridiculous. I mean, you wouldn't even get off the ground, ever. Because one plus one wouldn't even equal two. I mean, you'd have no way of putting things together. But everything consists in him and holds together in him. So he's the creator of the universe, and he's the sustainer of the universe. So science makes sense. Now, you have to adjust theories as you go along, and you learn more about truth, his truth. And the Christian scientist has the advantage of knowing that it's Jesus who holds all things together, but that doesn't necessarily make him a better scientist. It gives him a spiritual insight that the other person doesn't have. And what is the tool, or what are the tools of space science? And the basic tool is genius. Now, they use other tools. They use genius to make spaceships and things like that, but their basic tool is genius. Now, the second institution is the state. And where does it get its authority? From God. He's the appointer of kings. Jesus Christ is the appointer of kings. What's its origin? Well, I'm not exactly sure. Why do we need a state? Some of you may have theories more profound than anything I'm talking about. There are two books I would suggest that you might want to look at. This one is just a little booklet, and I think it's out of print. Some of you know it well. Paul Woolley, Family, Church, and State. I guess it's not more than 32 pages, but it's very suggestive and helpful if you can get a copy of it, or if it is out of print, I suppose it's permissible to Xerox, and I don't know. And the other is a little more substantial book by Jane Marcellus Cook, Church and State, which is a history of the relationship between the church and the state. Paul Woolley's booklet is very suggestive, very helpful. But at any rate, the origin of the state may be sin. It could be that if man had never sinned, we would not need a state. If everybody were without sin, we could all get along with each other without having to be organized. So maybe the origin of the state is sin. Maybe the origin of the state is the need for organization. Adam and Eve had children, and they had children, and they had children, and you know how those family trees grow. And pretty soon you had to organize the whole thing. You just couldn't any longer have your family in your cave and the next person in the next cave or whatever, and you had to organize. If you're going to fight wars, I guess, you had to decide who's going to be on which side and all that sort of thing. So maybe the need for organization is the cause of the state, or maybe the state is a gift of God's grace and should be looked at that way, that God gave us the state in order that we could be organized, because otherwise our sin would just, there'd be anarchy all the time. It would be like, WrestleMania, where they all get in the ring, and only one comes out. That's the way life would be, maybe, if there weren't a state. Now, what is the mandate of the state? What is it supposed to do? Well, there are some things that you can find in the Bible, and these things are found largely in Paul Woolley's little booklet. The mandate of the state might be to punish evil and to reward good. That's one of the mandates of the state, or to promote peace and prosperity, or to promote safety and social welfare. I think a mandate of the state certainly is to maintain an environment in which the gospel can be preached. I think the Roman government did that. I think that's why Jesus and Paul didn't attack the Roman government all the time, because it did what it was supposed to be doing. Pax Romana was based on the Lex Romana, the law of Rome. And so you had a lingua franca, you had a language, common language, but you also had the law of Rome that, as it seemed, allowed the gospel to progress, at least for a while. Who are the subjects of the state? Citizens. And this morning we heard a talk about citizens, and a talk that in some ways was similar to the kinds of things I'm trying to say. Some of them are Christians and some are not. And that's the way it is. What are the tools of the state? And the answer is the sword, or a pistol, or rifle, physical tools. If you take away the sword from the state, you've got a pretty much toothless lion. I mean, that's the tool of the state. It must have the sword. Did you have a question?
Is it okay to ask a question now?
Yeah, I probably won't know the answer, but you can go ahead.
Well, just there under the mandate, can you distinguish between the theocracy of Israel and the state after the incarnation of Christ?
No, I'm not really trying to get into that, because I know that's confusing and complicated, and I know how often some Christians lift things out of the Old Testament that were intended for Israel and say that's what the United States ought to be now, and those parallels aren't at all obvious to me. So I'm really just talking here generally about the state today. So I appreciate your question. It's a very profound question, but it needs a more profound...
Because I went to Westminster Seminary.
Oh. Huh. So you know what all the questions are. Pardon me, I'm kidding. There's some truth to that. The other category over here is church. The institution called church. Now, that Christ is related to that because he's the redeemer of Christians. Now, of course, he's also the redeemer of the state, and that gets you into some eschatology and all kinds of things. So this is a little simplistic. But he's the redeemer of Christians. Where does it get its authority? From God. What's its origin? The cross. What's the mandate of the church? Well, I just put two things. Communication, meaning communication between Christians and communication with God. And then mobilization, that is mobilizing themselves to serve in the world. Now you could do all kinds of other things. The mandate is to glorify God, whatever. Who are the subjects in the church? Christians. Now the question comes up, how are you identifying church here? I'm sort of talking about an ideal institutional church. You know, I'm sure there are non-Christians in the institutional church, and the church is the people of God, but I'm talking about the institution called church made up of Christians. I'm not getting into the question about are there non-Christians in the institutional church. Yes, there are. And what are the tools of the church? Well, they're not the sword or even genius, but the tools of the church are spiritual, because we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. And you can read that in Ephesians 6. Now, let me try to put some of this together just very quickly. There are a couple of things that you can draw from this, if it makes any sense at all. One is the church has no authority over the state. Only the Lord has authority over the state. So if the church is trying to express authority over the state, it's usurping the lordship of Christ. And the same thing works the other way. The state has no authority over the church. So if the state tries to exercise authority over the church, it's usurping the lordship of Christ. So none of these boxes should break out in this direction. That is, usurp the lordship of Christ, or they got to be put back in their place. I realize that's kind of crass, but I'm just saying that they've got to stay in their boxes. But another error that can be made is that the state can usurp the authority and the rights of the church, or vice versa. And when that happens, you got to get that corrected by one means or another. Now this is pretty simplistic, obviously, but I think there may be at least some validity to it. And I'm suspecting that in a few moments when Alan presents his situation, you'll see what at least appears to me, and I haven't studied it all that carefully, a violation of this kind, where the church is usurping the right, the state is usurping the right of the church and saying to the church, here is something that you must do. And it appears to be something God has commanded the church not to do. Now, let me look at the other sheet with you, just quickly, in order to respect Alan's time. The other sheet is a summary, because this was my interest primarily, a summary of the dangers of the church becoming too active in state affairs or the affairs of business. Now, this may not seem important to you, but when you realize that many of the churches in the world today devote themselves quite largely to the kind of ministry I'm talking about here, that is, this institution trying to influence these institutions, I think you then begin to realize that this may be an important issue, because a lot of things happen. For example, this kind of corporate involvement, that is the corporate involvement of the church in the life of the state improperly, And you look at the resolutions, for example, that the National Council of Churches, or for that matter, the United Presbyterian Church, you look at their resolutions that they pass year by year, and just tremendous involvement. Frankly, I think the basic theological issue is universalism. Now, that may be wrong, and that's a guess. I think that if a Christian, I have to be careful with this, if a Christian is a universalist, now, can a universalist be a Christian? I guess, I don't know. I mean, you could believe that Christ died for you, couldn't you, and be incredibly grateful for that, and want to serve him in every way that you could, and trust him as the Son of God while you also believed he died for everybody. Couldn't you? I don't know. You'd be wrong. So you know, it's sinful to be wrong, but could you still be a Christian? But at any rate, if these people, most of whom are different from most of us, more liberal in their perspectives, if some of them are Christians, and if some of them are sincere, and certainly some of them are sincere, but they don't believe that the church ought to do evangelism as we understand it, because there's no need to do that, which is what most of those people believe, that there's no need to do evangelism, then what are you going to do? If you really want to do something good for people, but evangelism is unnecessary or a waste of time, what are you going to do? You're going to do all these other things, social action kind of things, change society, influence the state, influence government, influence science, influence business. But there are so many defects with that. If that's your only ministry, and I've outlined some of them here, some of them are theological, anthropology, the doctrine of man, because you ignore the fall of man into sin. Van Riesen said that the utopians, as he calls them, are driven by homesickness for the lost paradise, and they long for the new earth. Their dreams are utopias, never to be realized, because they seek a road to such a paradise that does not pass along the station of the fall into sin. These people, this kind of activity where the church invades the work of the state and what properly belongs to the state, is one such that the infinite value of a soul can be forgotten. And Christendom today is largely seen by many people as one institution trying to influence another one or others. That is, it is the institution called church trying to influence the institution called state or business, not an individual called Christian trying to communicate with another individual. So individuals just get lost in the mass. I would guess that the more liberal denominations have done very little evangelism among the black people of South Africa. But they have poured in tremendous resources into ministry for the black people of South Africa from their perspective. So there is a deficiency in anthropology, there's a deficiency in soteriology. Men must first be reconciled to God. Regeneration is the only way to change human nature. Evangelism is misunderstood. I'm sure you've seen evangelism defined this way somewhere or other. This is George Weber's definition. In short, evangelism in its varied dimension is politics. Evangelism is politics. Now, there may be a lot of good in social witness and social action, and there is, and we should be involved in those kinds of things, and to some degree, although not as much larger degree as some people say, the evangelical church has failed in that area. We failed to be what Christ wanted us to be and wants us to be, but the evangelical church has had a tremendous social witness, especially through the last centuries. But that's still not evangelism, as you all understand. Nelson Bell wrote this in a letter: only too often the church seems more concerned about making the prodigal comfortable, happy, and prosperous in the far country than in bringing him back to his father through faith in Jesus Christ. And I think some of you can probably identify with that. Ecclesiology, the doctrine of the church. Well, one of the errors that can be made has to do with the power of the church. And the church today is trying to use, in many ways, the wrong kind of power. Her power is spiritual. Her power is not the majority vote or other kinds of tools, but her power is spiritual. In ecclesiology, the church gets into all kinds of identity problems. The church is identified with the kingdom, and that's wrong. The church is identified with Christ. In other words, the church says, "This, we have the authority of Christ. We, the church, have this authority, therefore we can tell the state what to do." And that's not right. The church is identified with the world, and some of you know about the kind of theology that makes no distinction between those who are Christ and those who are not Christ. So there are all kinds of identity confusions. The church is identified with the Christian. There may be things it's proper for the Christian to do, but not for the church to do. There might be something that it's proper for a soldier to do, but not for an army to do. A soldier can get married. It's a little difficult to see how an army would get married. Just because a Christian should do something in society does not necessarily mean that the church should do it. Eschatology. Here are some more questions raised about eschatology. The next major area has to do with Christology, the doctrine of Christ, the ministry of Christ, the lordship of Christ. And the error here is that of making Christ and the church virtually identical. And then there is the practical difficulty of corporate involvement. The church is thereby diverted from her primary task. The pronouncement itself, the church says we want to say something to the state. Well, who's to decide what needs to be said? Presumably, a pronouncement is God's will for a particular situation. They're always talking about what God is doing in the world. Who knows what God is doing in the world? I mean, he's doing everything that's being done. I understand that, but they will say, God is working in South Africa, and here is what he's doing. How do you know that? How do you know which side of black, which of the black groups to side with? I don't know how you identify that this is God's people there, and these are not God's people there. So there is great confusion about what God's purposes are and what God is doing now. Who knows God's will for China? Do you know God's will for China? The churches seem to, or God's will for Cuba, or God's will for South Africa. And where do you go for the answer? You know, Philippians? So the pronouncement itself is pretty difficult. The makers of the pronouncement seem generally to be church politicians, clergymen. What gives clergymen special insight into the affairs of business? The procedure of the pronouncement, or the statement, the responsibility for the pronouncement. There is no responsibility. I've seen this in the United Presbyterian Church. If I had the time and the energy and the desire, I'd like to go back and see what pronouncements the church has made to the state. Now, this would relate to Zimbabwe and South Africa and Botswana and Southwest Africa, Namibia, and that's just in that one corner of the world. I'd like to go back and analyze the statements the church has made and hold them accountable. But they all went home. I mean, they met for 1 week somewhere, and some of their leaders said, here are a bunch of pronouncements, and they all approved them, and they went home. So there's no responsibility. And maybe millions of people died because of those pronouncements and what they supported. Many of these pronouncements and much of the church activity, as you know, has looked very similar to communist causes in recent years. I'm not saying the church was run by communists. Don't misunderstand me. It does create confusion now because they don't know what to do when they don't have Russia around. I mean, you know, it's changed. The polity of the pronouncement, the effect of the pronouncement, the possibility of the pronouncement. Corporate involvement, its resulting disaster. By abdicating, L. Nelson Bell said this in that same letter, by abdicating her spiritual calling and message, the church is becoming increasingly irrelevant to man's basic need. So there's a cost in the world. The church becomes irrelevant. The church becomes disliked. The church is discredited. If you make pronouncements about politics and you don't know what you're talking about, it's unlikely you know what you're talking about when it comes to spiritual things. The church is ignored by people of responsibility because they know the church says trivial things about things it doesn't know about. The church is used by people for social ends. The cost to the church, loss of inner vitality. I think I could defend that in conversations I've had within the last week with people. There is less emphasis on personal religion, personal piety, loss of income. Now, that shouldn't matter if you're doing the right thing. Loss of unity. Church is already divided. And then finally, loss of members. And I think that can be easily demonstrated statistically. So what I'm suggesting to you is that these are separate institutions, all under the lordship of Christ. And when there is confusion, there is a price to pay. Now, there are times, I think, when the church can consider speaking to the state. For example, if the state is allowing murder, abortion, let's say, and one believes that one of the roles of the state is the safety of all of its inhabitants, to protect all of its people, and the state is not protecting a group of people, whether it happens to be blacks or Jewish people or unborn babies, the state then is not fulfilling its role under God. And I don't think it's out of order for the church to remind the state that you are not fulfilling what God called you to do. Now, he didn't call the state to be Christian, but he called the state to do certain things, maintain the safety of the people in the state. So I think there are times when the church can speak to the state quite properly. And there may even be times when the state has to speak to the church quite properly. When the church becomes a political lobby in Washington, pure and simple. Maybe the state has to say, wait a second, guys, that's not your business. It's okay for you to promote the well-being of people in our society, but you're just an out-and-out political lobby. And you know, get back in your box and do your thing. Okay, I'm prepared to stop now.